19 lip bloggers, one finalist, 5 nominees, one finalist, 5 authors, 1 podcaster, 5 Mondays, 5 interviews, 1 podcast. Anyway, the hell with it. It's the LBC Podcast! C. Max McGee.
Astronaut. A man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
C. Max McGee
will be that man. Better than he was before. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Hello out there in podcast land. Welcome to week number 2 of the LBC Podcast. My name is Edward Champion, and I hope that you are hanging in there. We have, in fact, offered you a considerable amount of Andrew Monson-related information over the past week, and showing that, you know, really we're unstoppable, we will be doing the same with Elizabeth Crane this week. So this is the first stroke in an unapologetic tsunami of Elizabeth Crane-related coverage. Anyway, first off, had I known that I would be actually engineering these podcasts during a Saturday night, I might likely have hired a flamenco dancer. Unfortunately, there is no flamenco dancer here. I am quite alone. It's raining outside. I may hire a flamenco dancer next week. I'm not certain. But maybe if you have some ideas as to what kinds of activities might actually pass for flamenco dancing, I would be happy to go ahead and hear them. Anyway, this week's author is Elizabeth Crane. She has authored a book called All This Heavenly Glory, which is a collection of stories put out by Little Brown. Now, this book concerns a character named Charlotte Ann Byers, and the book follows her from childhood all the way into adulthood with all sorts of digressions and asides, and we'll be talking with Miss Crane further about this. Before we actually do that, we will talk with C. Max McGee. He operates the website The Millions, which I do, in fact, read every day, and I encourage you to do so. And C. Max McGee was kind enough to talk to me for about a minute, so here he is.
So I'm here with C. Max McGee, who is the nominator for Elizabeth Crane's All This Heavenly Glory. How are you doing, Max?
I'm doing great.
So what was it about the Crane book that really made it worthwhile for you to nominate?
I think that Elizabeth has a really unique voice that I hadn't really encountered anything quite like it in other books I've read. And that was really what struck me right away when I was reading that book.
What was it about the voice that really sort of struck you?
Well, it's conversational. It's she does a lot of lists and a lot of asides, and you know, at first you think maybe that it's a little, a little flighty, but there's a lot of depth there too. She really manages to pack a lot of information into her writing just by the way that she writes.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Max.
Very easy.
It's very easy.
Very easy to make mashed potatoes.
Yes, it is, actually.
I'm not really much of a cook, or I might have known that sooner than yesterday, but I just discovered this.
Really? How recently was this?
No, seriously, yesterday. I made mashed potatoes for the first time.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I know. They're really easy to make.
Yeah, you kind of just mash them.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
I actually, every Thanksgiving, I'm the designated potato masher.
Oh, is that right?
There's something zen about mashing the hell out of potatoes.
It was great.
Yeah.
I just thought it would be harder, and I thought there would be more things that you had to put into it. And
you know, people they really don't want to mash potatoes. But I don't understand. I like mashing potatoes.
Do you have a potato masher?
Yeah, yeah. I just mash them in a...
That just goes, it like glides through like it's butter.
Oh, okay. I like physically mashing them, but
oh.
I don't know. It's you know, it's sort of like the same reason why I'm obsessed with, like, you know, watching a piece of paper go on fire.
Yes, or why my husband and my stepbrother have something for 15 minutes to discuss about vacuum cleaners.
You know, I mean, if you go into, like, for example, the history of the umbrella, it's actually really interesting. But the guy who bravely opened an umbrella, if it weren't for him, we men would not have actually be using umbrellas, because umbrellas were considered in their early days quite feminine. And this guy, Jonas Handy, I believe was his name, he says, you guys are completely ridiculous. And he's this philanthropist. And so what he does is he goes ahead and he starts using an umbrella. And the men initially sort of, you know, laugh at him. But 50 years later...
But he was dry.
Yes, but he was dry. And 50 years later, the men actually started using umbrellas.
Wow. So that is interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it's only because people like me get obsessed with umbrellas that, you know, look these pieces of facts up that you anyway, okay, well let's talk
you
about
got your levels now.
Oh yeah, we definitely got the levels. Okay, I'll probably keep that in. Why not? There should be more mashed potato discussion.
Fantastic.
Okay, so anyway, this book, which book is it? All This Heavenly Glory,
yes.
Which I am familiar with. It invited comparisons to me with Elizabeth Mackenzie's Stop This Girl, and not just because you both share the same name, Elizabeth, but it also involved a young girl sort of growing into adulthood. I was wondering, did you swipe the idea from her? Or
no, actually, apparently we were probably writing them around the same time. They came out around the same time,
yeah?
So we must have been writing them the same time, and actually... not to get too far off track, but she and I and another Elizabeth,
a third Kraken, Elizabeth,
all very not intentionally, yeah. As I'm sure,
yeah,
were commissioned to write stories for Stories on Stage here in Chicago.
Yes,
and it was sort of amusing that the two of us, well, that we were all three named Elizabeth, but that she had that we had similarly themed. Short story collection. So the answer is no.
Okay. Well, how did the stories actually come about?
Well, you know, I had written a number of the stories where she's a child.
Yeah.
A while ago, those were some of the first stories that I'd written, and I always had it in mind to write a complete collection based on that character. And there was a point at which I'd written enough that I sort of thought I might be able to fill in the holes. And I also thought that it might be tedious to have all of the stories be in her childhood, mm-hmm. particularly in the style that I wrote them in. And so I thought, well, let's see, what if we sort of go back and forth between her childhood and her adulthood? And so I sort of went from there.
Now, where would you draw the line between blatant autobiographical fiction and entirely invented fiction? Because I know that you worked in a video store at one point.
Yes, I did. Well, here, this particular... where would I draw the line? You know, I think that's one of those questions that's so hard to answer. I mean, I can tell you what my experience is. There's a lot of... A great deal of this came out of my own life. I have no issue saying that.
Mm-hmm.
I call it fiction, and I write fiction, not just because I make things up, things are exaggerated, and things are not necessarily exactly in the right time. I've had an interesting life, I think, and so it lends itself to a lot of ideas, but I've never really been a person who's been able to just sit down and say, oh, when I was six, I sang in the opera, because that's where it ends there for me. It doesn't seem very interesting. But if I sort of twist it into this and that, then I get something that I would rather read. Anyway, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, Owen Wilson, however, that is very interesting to you.
Well, I had to put in someone that I thought was cute, at least.
Well, you actually, when we emailed, you were kind enough to inform me that Cato Kaelin actually had a television talk show. I had no idea. I'm wondering...
you haven't seen it yet, have you?
Yeah. No, I haven't. I'm too afraid and too busy. But I also, on your blog, I noted that you had a bit of an obsession with Kevin Federline. And I'm wondering, how much does pop culture influence your writing?
Oh, very much. I mean, I'm a kid who totally grew up in front of the TV. Mm-hmm. I'm an only child, and my mom was, she was an opera singer, like the character in the book. So she was away a lot, but even when she was home, I still was just, it was a lot of my entertainment. I mean, hours and hours in front of the TV. It's a wonder I've read anything at all, really. But I think that's true for a lot of people, a lot of intelligent people. I don't know, something about celebrities and certain celebrities, celebrity behavior, it fascinates me what people get away with when they're famous, and that the rules sort of seem to change. And I also, part of the reason I'm interested in Kevin Federline and Britney Spears is because they share a wedding anniversary. They were married on the exact same day that my husband and I were married.
Really?
Yes. And so I feel invested in their marriage.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit of a slight kind of a numerologist myself. I mean, not in the sense that I subscribe, but I'm very, very obsessed with coincidences along those lines for no
apparent. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know why. Yeah, it's numbers are very, very fun to me. But you know, I'm thinking maybe you might sort of share this slightly pathological sort of distinction.
I don't know if it's a number thing or just a thing that like those two are so clearly different than I am.
Yeah.
You know, you've obviously read Amy Bender's book, by the way.
Yes, yes, I have.
The one about numbers.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and we talked about that, actually.
Oh, you did? That's cool.
Yeah, so, okay, well, anyway, I guess, well, then how, right now, then, how have you managed to sort of wean yourself gradually off of television? I mean, how much do you read, and how, I mean, what are your influences when you actually sat down to write a new sort of story?
Well, a lot of different things. We were actually talking, and I'm teaching a class at University of Chicago right now, fiction workshop, and we were talking about, we went around the room and talked about what inspires us, and, you know, for me, that can be anything. I mean, great fiction constantly inspires me, and I feel like I've been reading lately stuff that I've just been so excited about. From Rick Moody's new book, which I still haven't finished, to I read two stories right before class that I had to change my course packet because I was so excited.
Wow!
One was by Joyce Carol Oates, written sort of in the form of notes. Another one by John Edgar Wideman about this man who's sort of obsessed with his friend's son who's in prison, and his use of language is just like music. There's that, and, you know, I've been watching short films lately, 3-minute films, which seems to be a new genre that I don't know where it came from, but they're something about that form probably appealed to me because they're like short stories.
Film students who didn't have $200,000.
Exactly. But you know, if you know, 3 minutes, you can tell a nice little story in three minutes. Movies and even television. I mean, I saw, like, I'm just going to say this, but I was going to take a nap yesterday and I was flipping channels and Maury Povich came on yet again, and he had on People with Phobias. And this is something that I've been meaning to write a story about for a long time. And I mean, but weird phobias, you know, like mustard and pickles and balloons. And
the fear of shaving or something like that.
It was a horrifying show because he was purposely trying to torture them with the things that they were afraid of. And it didn't seem very productive at all.
That's terrible.
It was really terrible. That part of it was really, really terrible. But what really interested me was looking at these people's reactions and thinking about, like, how one thing could frighten you so much to the point where you can't leave your house because you're afraid of birds.
Maury Tough Love Povich, man.
Oh, he was terrible. He's like, stop shaking.
Jesus.
Like, oh my God, that's awful.
This is what is on television these days? Jeez.
Yeah. My God. Yeah.
That's terrible. I mean, it's fascinating and terrible at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
So I wrote down a ton of notes because I just couldn't believe, like, this one woman is afraid of dogs, and she said, he said, why? And she said, because they're evil demons waiting to just eat you.
Jeez. Well, that's interesting. Well, I mean, there's
anything. Pretty much anything can inspire me. Life, like, continually inspires me. Mashing potatoes.
Yeah.
Honestly,
yeah.
Because the thing that interests me the most about mashing potatoes is that I can work it up in my head that mashed potatoes is such a big deal, and so I'll avoid it and not do it, and then it turns out to be nothing.
Well, as we were sort of establishing earlier, though, there is joy, there is emotion in mashing potatoes. And as a result, that joy is a human experience that can then be sort of put into fiction.
It's very true. Yeah. It's very true.
Well, anyway, I don't want to digress too much from the literary stuff, but unfortunately we
did.
I wanted to talk to you about the story Harold the Filmmaker, which I particularly like, but this also appeared in Nerve, and I'm wondering how you got involved with Nerve with this.
I can't remember now. It's been a while. I know that they have since then tried to get me to submit some more stuff. I don't write that much that really would fit in with... That was about the only thing that I had to submit to them that seemed remotely related to their content. But I probably at that point I was still just trying to get stories published. Because
mm-hmm.
that was published fairly early on, I think, in my publishing career.
Okay. Well, the thing that's interesting in this is that in addition to... In this book, is that in addition to sort of motifs such as Owen Wilson, you also have, you know, pornography, a mother dying of cancer. I'm wondering, how much does the juxtaposition of what might be called sort of, you know, I don't know, pedantic motifs with very sort of human motifs, how much are you concerned with that?
You know what? I don't think about it too much. I think more about... honestly, I just think about what interests me. And hopefully, when I start to really look at something that seems to be turning into a collection, then I start to look at, do they fit together? Do the themes and the stories cohere? And in this one in particular, since it's one character, like, I wanted to have some semblance of a progression in her life. And so I don't worry about it too much. I kind of just hope that the style and the theme and everything will somehow glue together. We were watching, I blogged about this a little bit, but we were watching a PBS thing about artists recently, and I was very amused by Andy Warhol's answer, you know, to some question about how do you go about, you know, what do you think about the importance of your work or whatever it was? And he was just like, can I just say, because sometimes the answer is, I don't know.
Well, I should point out that I read that you published a letter in the New York Times decrying the existence of the blueberry bagel.
Yes.
What do you say to someone who says, come on, Elizabeth, do such issues really need to be talked about and written about?
Well, my letters to the New York Times were always in response to something that was, you know, something on the op-ed page or whatever. And there was somebody else who had written some op-ed piece about the blueberry bagel. And I felt very understood that these things shouldn't be mixed, and so I wrote it.
Why? What's wrong with that? If people
I
want...
I don't think that fruit and, like, it's sweet and savory together. It's not really my thing. And bagels go with cream cheese. You don't want cream cheese on your blueberry bagel. That's just weird.
Yeah, it is a bit weird, but...
now, since then, they've put all kinds of weird things in bagels.
Pumpkin bagels, that's...
Yeah,
that I don't get.
That's what muffins are for. That's
chocolate
what
chip bagels.
For.
What's up with that, you know? Anyway, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, the lists and the data and the footnotes and the phrasing, actually, reminded me very much of David Foster Wallace.
Well, that's nice.
And in fact, you also share Mr. Wallace's publisher, Little Brown.
Yes,
now,
we do.
I do note that there was an essay that you wrote in Pals about this, but how much of an influence is Wallace? And do you think that possibly shaking off the influence is a burden for you in terms of developing your voice more?
It's not something I really think of consciously. Wallace and Rick Moody and a couple of other people are actually authors who I came to sort of later. And what kind of blew my mind, just because this was how I had been writing letters to people,
mm-hmm.
but not, it didn't occur to me that I could do that in my fiction.
Mm.
And it was really revelatory for me when I found out that people were doing this. And so I think that basically if anybody wants to compare me to him, that's great. I'm not even worried that I'm going to be in that category ever. But I think really what he reading him does for me more than anything is just give me license to write how I naturally write. And thank God.
But let's say that there's a particularly sort of stingy B.R. Myers type who reads an Elizabeth Crane book and says, well, you know what, this came after David Foster Wallace, and Wallace has mined this territory, and thus it's proprietary, and Crane looks like it's a knockoff here. What would you say to that?
Well, that's fine. You know, I realize that he didn't pioneer footnotes. I know that.
No.
As well.
No. Well, obviously.
Which makes me feel a little bit better about it.
Yeah.
And also... you know, there's a point at which criticism, you kind of just have to not take it too personally. I mean, they just, Michiko Kakutani?
Yes.
Just referred to she gave him a glowing review for his new book of essays.
Yeah.
But within this review, she referred to his previous two short story collections as being throwaways.
Yeah, yeah. I remember
this. And if, you know, if she's calling David Foster Wallace two of his books throwaways, granted, that's in the context of him being a genius or whatever.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if that's the case, I aspire to be a throwaway.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm sort of suggesting here is because, like, there's a lot of similar sort of phrasings in your writing and his. And so I'm wondering if you ever feel that there is, like, maybe I'm channeling him too much, or maybe I need to write in a way that is not quite so explicitly formed with these long, lengthy sentences and these with regard tos and all that.
I don't worry about it too much.
Okay.
I don't worry about it too much. I think my long sentences are different than his long sentences and probably not nearly as smart and... the one concession I have sort of made is that I probably won't do too many footnotes in the future.
You know, there are no footnotes that aside from that one story in this book by comparison. So.
Yeah, and there were some in a couple of others, and I actually there weren't too many, and so I just sort of put them in parens, so that people wouldn't be so distracted by the David Foster Wallace thing.
Actually, though,
I think that my publishers probably took me in spite of that and not because of it.
Actually, though, the thing that I think that one of Wallace's weaknesses is that he doesn't actually really put things into parenthetical statements. And actually, sometimes, though, when it's like a footnote and you go all the way to like the back of the book or whatever, or, you know, down below, and it's like three words, it's like, why did I go to all that trouble when you could just put it in parentheses, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
So maybe you might be able to kind of innovate on the parenthetical front. Where he
perhaps has
innovated on the footnote front.
Perhaps.
Okay. Let's see here.
It's all digression to me. I mean, footnotes are technically supposed to be. To me, it's just all another place to put digression.
Why do you think there's such a war on digression in postmodernism?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it's a really natural way to the mind works.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, conversationally speaking, I mean, you think there's almost like this resistance to reproducing explicit conversation within the actual text or prose of a book? Or,
huh.
I don't know, that's a theory.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it.
You know, like if we put like gosh and gee willikers or other sort of asides, like, you know, in the text, I mean, yes, they become very prominent because we expect a very formalistic kind of textual approach. We expect our plotting and our like... Yes,
exactly.
The room
is
smoky dark.
Who I'm helping do a little bit of editing on her second novel right now.
Oh, who?
A friend of mine.
Oh, okay. I thought you might mention a name and I didn't hear it. Damn it!
Well, I don't want to give any public criticism for her.
Okay.
She's a really great writer. But she has a habit of putting, by the way, an awful lot.
Really?
And I don't know that people... I don't think people say it that much.
Hmm. By the way, yeah, I think people say
you
that.
You do?
I don't know. I mean, you know what, actually, though? This may be a parochial kind of thing. I mean, at least the people here in California, particularly like the intellectual crowd, we always say, oh, and by the way, in a sort of kind of... I don't know why. I mean, it's sort of like... It's kind of like the... It depends on what the context you're using it in. I hate to ramble about this, but
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're going ahead and, like, you want to go ahead and give someone a piece of information... Like, you know, at the last minute and surprise them, then, oh, and by the way, is like the perfect thing to say.
I think this is more in the context of trying to change, like, switch the conversation to a different line of discussion, and it seemed awkward to me. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Okay. Now I'll have to look at it again.
Yeah. Well, actually, no. But the point here is that we can go ahead and say these things within quote marks, but we can't actually say them explicitly, sort of in the text. And I don't know. I mean, maybe there's something going on here. Maybe that's why the people who might decry your work as David Foster Wallace derivative. Maybe what we're really sort of talking about here is a sort of resistance to this in text. I don't know.
I have no idea.
Okay, well, we'll go to another topic then. Daniel Green, who is actually one of the members of the Litblog Co-op, he has pointed out that When the Messenger is Hot was frequently categorized in the chick lit section. Now, does the chick lit thing bother you at all?
I'm technically not supposed to talk about it because I posted on my blog several months ago, and I actually, the headline was C blank 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 K L blank T.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of made a public vow never to use those words together
mm-hmm.
again. But it bothers me not, you know, partly for myself, but more because it just seems so dismissive.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what I do. I would be. And part of the reason I don't think that's what I do is because if I did, I would be making a lot more money. Because those books apparently sell. I just think it reduces the potential quality of a work. You know, like any sort of heading like that might do. But I had a bee in my bonnet about it a while back.
Yeah, but at the same time, the thing about the chick lit term is that it really isn't entirely specific. It means different things to different people.
Right.
And if there's any sort of commonality, it's the whole notion that if you write about women's issues and you
right.
are a woman writer in
right.
any way, that you are all of a sudden chick lit. Doesn't
right.
matter if you are, you know, Curtis Sittenfeld, who doesn't really care for the term and is a little bit more dismissive of certain authors, or if you are,
yeah, right.
you know, or if you are, you know, even Doris Lessman, you know.
I think that those themes, I mean, so why isn't a book by a man about a man? Very little of it is called, like, referred to as dick lit.
Yeah.
Although that term is out there, it's not used well.
Well, dick lit doesn't sell. I mean, Kyle Smith's Love Monkey, men don't like to read about. Apparently, anyway, men don't like to read about their own sort of male anxieties. Although there is the new Nick Laird book that's out, Utterly
Who?
Monkey. Nick Laird?
I don't know it.
Oh, it's, Nick Laird, now I'm suspicious.
Oh, Nick Laird, yeah.
Yeah, Zadie Smith's husband.
Right, right.
She, apparently, he has a new book called Utterly Monkey, and it's all about, you know, male sort of, you know, whatever, 20s, 30s, blah, blah, blah. So
I think it's supposed to be good, isn't it?
I've heard it's good, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, going back to this, though, I mean, yeah, I mean, why, I was going to ask you, like, how we actually sort of defeat this particular sort of, you know, paradigm, but I've explored that question far too many times. Instead, I'm going to ask you, how do you think this affects you as a writer? Do you think that the chick lit sort of labeling really kind of undermines your contributions to letters?
Well, you know, it's not. I mean, I do what I do, so I try not to concern myself too much with how it's perceived. I take some consolation in the fact that the way that I see it is that most of the reviews that I've gotten for both books, for the first one I think more so even,
mm-hmm.
Have usually when those two words come up, the C and the L,
yeah.
It tends to be like, the quote will be something like, it's too bad that she gets lumped into this category.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would be dismissive to say this is what she is, you know, to use this to describe her work, because it's deeper than that. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And also I know that that's not how my publishers have thought of me or marketed me. So, you know, in the end, I just do what interests me and what I can do, and I can't really control how it's seen.
Two last questions, but the first one to jump off of this, as a woman writer, do you feel that there are hurdles in the publishing industry, particularly because you write in a particularly stylistic manner, that prevents you from sort of preserving and maintaining this distinctive voice? Do you come up with a lot of opposition?
No, I think that's been a real advantage to me. I mean, I didn't really even know. I was the sort of writer who had written up until I started reading people who wrote stylistically differently. I thought that I had to write in a really sort of neat, very straightforward way, and I didn't realize that I had room to write in a way that felt natural to me. With my first book, it was surprising how quickly I found a publisher. I'm not too worried about it. I think there's always room for good writing, and I hope that I'll continue to write stuff that people like enough to put it out there.
Now, I understand that you basically fled from New York to Chicago. I'm wondering how much of the Charlotte Anne stories was a purging of this sort of the New York fears or whatever.
A lot of it, yeah. I mean, my creative life is really rocketed here in a way that it couldn't in New York, because I was constantly worried about money, mm-hmm. Paying the rent, and that and the physicality of New York just did not agree with me. It took me so long to get out of there. Mm. But Chicago is so much less of a claustrophobic city. Mm-hmm. And being able to see out windows and see the sunshine and be able to afford to do more than just stay in my apartment, because that's all I had money for. And
now, come on, you haven't really considered the aesthetics of the brick wall now, you know? When you open up the window and see it, it's actually, there's more going on there.
I don't miss it that much. Yeah. I really don't. So that's a very big aspect of my story and hers, definitely.
Okay. Well, Elizabeth, I have another author to talk with, but thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
See you.